Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Rafael Goyeneche, president of Metropolitan Crime Commission. He joins us every Thursday in the 12 o'clock hour, and we certainly appreciate the time that he puts in prep for the show, bringing a lot of great information. His organization follows so many different, very important topics that happen in the criminal justice system. And what we're going to talk about today is something that's really unique and different for certain.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
There's never a shortage of new material. And, this past week didn't disappoint.
So let's talk about this. I mean, it almost feels like it's been going on forever, but it hasn't really been that long. But every day is a new revelation.
Well, it changes from hour to hour. So this time last week, we were talking about the possible, grand jury investigation and what the possibilities were, never imagining that a couple of hours after I completed our segment, that the attorney general would be indicted. And since last Thursday, this whole indictment has taken on a life of its own. And basically, the indictment was dead on arrival for all intents and purposes. The Supreme Court stepped in immediately and stayed it. But I think that, before we get to that, let's bring the audience up to speed on how we got to last Thursday and what went wrong along the way. And so let's start off by, pointing out that this indictment has its roots in this past legislative session, where the legislature consolidated the two clerks of court's office. So back in 2006, New Orleans was the only jurisdiction in the state of Louisiana that had seven assessors, two criminal sheriffs, and two assessors. The legislature passed legislation requiring the consolidation of those offices. The sheriff's offices were consolidated. The seven assessors were consolidated into one, but they never got around to consolidating the clerks before the law was repealed. It was repealed because New Orleans had more clout in the legislature back then. So fast forward to this past session. The legislature passed Act 15 that called for the consolidation of the two clerks of court. The impetus for that was fiscal, because with two clerks of court, civil and criminal, you basically have clerks generate revenue. The civil clerk generates revenue. The criminal clerk does not generate revenue. So as a result of the revenue that civil clerks derive from court filings, the city of New Orleans has to contribute no money to the civil clerk's office or to the operations of civil district court. Conversely, on the criminal clerk's responsibilities, the city this year has appropriated $6.5 million to fund the criminal clerk's office because it generates no revenue. Additionally, the state has to supplement the operations of criminal court to the tune of about $1 million a year because there is no revenue. So the legislature passed this act consolidating the two clerks' offices primarily as a fiscal measure. So this is saving the city millions of dollars. The civil clerk not only generates enough revenue annually to operate all of civil court and the responsibility of the civil clerk of court, through the years they've amassed a surplus of over $20 million. That surplus can now be used to fund the consolidated clerks of court offices. At a time when the city, is fishing around for quarters in the sofa to balance the books, This legislative act is manna from heaven. It's going to save the city millions of dollars. But it evolved into a political issue. So when the governor signed this act into law in April, the district attorney, Jason Williams, wrote a letter to the city council and to the mayor saying that the legislature created a new office of a single clerk and said that the city needed to call a special election and appoint an interim clerk of court. Liz Merle, who is the attorney for the state of Louisiana and defends the actions of the legislature, wrote a letter shortly after that to the mayor and to the council saying the DA is wrong. They didn't create a new office. They consolidated the two offices together. And she urged them to stand down and wait and let the Louisiana Supreme Court rule on the matter because litigation was pending at that time. The city council and the mayor ignored that. They passed a resolution in the council to call a special election and to appoint an interim clerk of court. After that, after they did that, the civil clerk filed a lawsuit against the city saying that the city's actions were depriving her of her lawful duties as the clerk of the consolidated clerk's offices now. After the lawsuit was filed, a day after Chelsea Napoleon filed that lawsuit against the city, Liz Merle stepped in and wrote a letter to the council, to the mayor, and to the DA saying, you know, I asked you to wait until the Supreme Court ruled on this. The Supreme Court will be ruling shortly. But she also cited what you have done is potentially deprive Chelsea Napoleon of her rightful duties to operate the clerk of court by appointing an interim clerk of court. So what Liz Merle cited a state law and cited what the penalties for violating that state law are. It was a misdemeanor law and it cited the penalties for that. Then that day or the next day, Mayor Moreno posted on social media a video basically saying that she considered that letter that the attorney general wrote a threat. And she cited the state felony public intimidation law that you're attempting to intimidate us. Liz Merle, as the attorney general, has a responsibility, a constitutional responsibility, to defend the laws of the state of Louisiana. Attorney generals issue hundreds of opinions and advisory opinions every year and have for decades. So what the attorney general did was basically inform the city that you need to stand down and wait and let the Supreme Court decide this case. And ultimately, the Supreme Court, a few days later, did decide that Act 15 did not create a new office. It merely consolidated the two clerks' offices and basically agreed with the position of the Attorney General in this. So everybody thought that this was over with. It was done. But come to find out that apparently at some point in time, the regular grand jury in Orleans Parish self-directed, you know, quote unquote, self-directed and initiated an investigation to determine if the attorney general's letter was in fact a act of public intimidation, a threat. So I'm a former prosecutor. You're a former police officer. So when your deputies made arrests and interceded, it was pretty common practice, you know, for people to get angry and threaten them and, you know, say that they were going to have their jobs and they were going to be, in behind bars for doing this or going to be fired for doing it. As prosecutors, I would see those cases all the time come through. And the district attorney's office during my tenure, you know, which is in the 80s, rarely, if ever, accepted those cases. So I took a look, beginning in 2022, how many of those public intimidation cases had been initiated by the district attorney's office in Orleans Parish. I found 6 cases. All 6 of those cases were accepted for prosecution, but all 6 of those cases were ultimately dismissed by the same DA that accepted those cases. I've never seen a letter result in an arrest or an indictment for public intimidation. I've read that letter. I don't consider it a threat. In fact, you know, I pointed out that the mayor, after she received that letter, went on social media and talked about the fact that that could be a violation of state law. Was the mayor trying to threaten the attorney general with a prosecution? My response to that is absolutely not. The mayor was merely citing the law, just as the attorney general was citing the law when she wrote the letter that to the mayor, to the DA, and to the council, saying that your actions could be a violation of the law. If the attorney general intended to prosecute the mayor, the council, or the DA, that letter was written May the 15th. Of May the 13th, she would have indicted them and charged them long before then. She did, the attorney general did, what she urged the city to do. She waited for the Supreme Court to rule. The Supreme Court ruled and agreed with her interpretation of the law. The matter was closed until we found out last Thursday that it wasn't over, because this grand jury has been receiving evidence about public intimidation and last Thursday issued a 16-count indictment against the attorney general for 8 counts of public intimidation and 8 counts of malfeasance in office. So, yeah, I pointed out that I'm a former prosecutor. If you're going to charge somebody with public intimidation, you're going to talk to the people that were intimidated. So that letter was directed to the district attorney. That letter was directed to the mayor and to the council members. I'm not going to indict anybody until they appear before the grand jury and testify that they felt intimidated by all of this. And that apparently happened. I don't know. I'm not privy to that, but I can't imagine a prosecutor going to indictment without taking testimony from the people that felt intimidated. And those letters were specifically directed to those elected public officials. So I know that, you know, what ended up happening after that indictment is something that I've never seen happen before. Before the ink was literally dry on the indictment, the Supreme Court stayed the indictment, and, you know, that was on a holiday weekend that the Supreme Court had to assemble and deal with this issue. And, you know, as a result of that, the special prosecutor in this case failed to honor the order of the Supreme Court staying the case. The capias arrest warrant for the attorney general had failed to be removed from the system, so the attorney general's legal counsel had to go back to the Supreme Court over the weekend and get them to issue another order directing the special counsel to withdraw the arrest warrant. In their ruling, in the Supreme Court's ruling, they said the reason that we're granting the stay is because the merits of this case are lacking, and indicated that they're issuing the stay because they believe the facts support the position of the attorney general's attorneys in this, and that they would entertain a motion to quash. So that's what's happening right now. Yesterday, the case was assigned to judges in criminal district court, and one by one, all 12 judges recused themselves from this case. They recused themselves because the attorney general prosecutes about 20% of the docket in criminal district court, meaning that all of those judges recognize that there is the appearance of and potential for a conflict of interest to be presiding over a criminal case against the attorney general's office when they're presiding over attorney general cases on their dockets. Additionally, they pointed out that the special counsel in this case was somebody that used to work with some of the judges in criminal district court. She was a peer. The special counsel was Laurie White. Laurie White was a former judge in criminal district court for about 15 years. After she left the court, she was in private practice. She went back and she was doing some criminal defense work. So when the DA's office was presented with the responsibility of working with the grand jury that quote unquote initiated an investigation of the attorney general, the DA had to recuse himself because he is quote unquote a victim of that. So that meant that the judge, Judge Leon Roche, who was in charge of the grand jury, had to appoint a special prosecutor. So Judge Leon Roche's responsibility is to choose someone that is qualified for that office. The person that he selected to be the special prosecutor is so conflicted that the Supreme Court referenced it in their ruling staying the indictment in this case. So what were some of the conflicts that the special counsel had? One is under state law, when you are appointed as a special prosecutor, you step into the shoes of the district attorney. Under state law, the district attorney has to be a resident of the parish in which he is performing his duties as district attorney. Laurie White, who is appointed by Judge Roche, lists with the Louisiana Bar Association her residence as being in Folsom, Louisiana, not a resident of Orleans Parish. Additionally, Laurie White, when she was a judge in criminal district court, she was being investigated by the Judiciary Commission based on a complaint that was filed by one of her employees about sexual harassment. She ultimately resigned or retired from the bench. That employee filed a civil suit against Laurie White. Laurie White, because she was a judge at the time, was being defended by the Attorney General's office. So when Judge Roche appointed her as a special prosecutor, apparently, he didn't ask her if she had anything in her background that would be problematic and be a conflict of interest, because he appointed her when she was being defended by the Attorney General's office. He appointed her when she didn't reside in the parish. He appointed her when she was still representing criminal defendants. And, you know, those are basic fundamental things that a judge has to determine before he or she appoints somebody in that position. So Judge Roche failed to follow the law. And is it any wonder, because he's the same judge a year ago that the Metropolitan Crime Commission filed a complaint against with the Louisiana Judiciary Commission, because he presided over 13 felony judge trials in which he acquitted those defendants. And in each of those 13 judge trials, no witnesses were called. Under Louisiana law, a trial doesn't commence until the first witness was sworn in. No witnesses were sworn in, but the judge still acquitted him, all of those individuals in that particular, you know, in that. So that's why we filed a complaint. And I think that the judge's actions now are probably going to be subject to an investigation by the Louisiana Judiciary Commission. So if the judge is now post-indictment, basically agreeing that he should recuse himself, it calls into question, why didn't he recuse himself pre-indictment when all of these same conflicts existed for him? So this isn't going to end well for him. I think that essentially this indictment is dead in the water. There will be a hearing. The Supreme Court just appointed an ad hoc to preside over this case. A retired appellate court judge has been assigned by the Supreme Court. The Attorney General's legal representatives will file a motion to quash. It'll be litigated, and whoever presides or wins in that is going to appeal that ruling to the Louisiana Supreme Court. Ultimately, the Louisiana Supreme Court will decide this, but the Supreme Court has already showed their hand by indicating the conflicts and the problems with this indictment. That's why I'm saying I believe that the indictment is for all intents and purposes dead in the water. And now what Absolutely. We're seeing is okay, go ahead.
Let's pick up there because we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafi Goyeneche, President of Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. You know, Rafi, as we continue this, just a couple of observations. When we go back in on the timeline when the council decided to call for the special election, it wasn't a unanimous vote on the council. In fact, There were several council members that didn't participate or didn't vote for it, saying that they still had time, that the deadline for calling a special election, if their position was going to be true, was like 2 weeks away. And they could have called a special meeting and met and called for the special election. So there was no exigency in doing what they desired to do. They just did it. And you know, in contrary to what the best advice that
Justice Weimer, yeah,
that you know that everyone gave, including the Louisiana Supreme Court, who predicted that this is what was going to happen. And what ultimately happened is we had the council's selection showing up at an election warehouse because there was an election that was going to be had, and this new clerk, Chelsea Napoleon, was going to be in charge of it, and Ms. Napoleon showing up at the election warehouse. Now, thankfully, the judge who was appointed by the council had enough sense to know this has become a crazy town, USA, and, yep. didn't become aggressive and overt and sat back and ultimately left, and Ms. Napoleon did what she was legally required to do under the law. So, that could have been a whole nother debacle that had occurred. But you know what's interesting about Judge Roche? He's actually got a bone to pick with a whole lot of people, because when he recuses himself, he writes a letter where he basically is trashing Ms. Rodrigue, who is the lawyer representing the AG, 2 pages of a 3-page filing that of his recusal order is all about trashing her. And, you know, I came across a Facebook video where He says, and I quote, "I'm not the bad guy in this courtroom. Jeff Landry is, Senator Morris is, and Laura Cannizzaro is," about the cut of the judges and the fact that they didn't do last in, first out. He was able to somehow manipulate away. He says it was through prayer and that God spared his seat. It had nothing to do with his cousin, Senator Gary Carter, who actually, he also says in the video, he wasn't on that committee. He actually was on the committee, but had resigned from the committee. So everybody knew the relationship. Every legislator I've talked to knew the relationship between Judge Roche and Senator Gary Carter. It was no big secret. In fact, I've been told multiple times this was a compromise for Senator Gary Carter, quite frankly. They make no bones about it, you know. But obviously he's upset now because the judge that was removed, Judge Good, says, "I'm running against Leon Roche." And yep. Now he's trying to make himself out to be the victim when, you know, and I've said this for weeks now, whoever was in there manipulating this, step forward, please. Don't be a coward. Let everybody know exactly what happened so that we can get down to the truth, because the truth will set you free here. And I doubt for a moment, I never doubt the power of the Lord. The Lord is the center of my universe. But God did not spare this man's seat. Yep. I'll go on record now.
Yep. Now, I agree with you. And this morning you called me and asked me if I had seen that video. And I had not. If you want to hide something from me, you put it on social media. So yeah, I had never seen
it. Me too.
But you sent it to me, and I watched it. And I heard some of your commentary at the beginning of your show. And then I watched the video in preparation for this segment. And a couple of things struck me that you didn't cover. You know, when Judge Roche was talking about this whole process, he was talking about the fact that the legislature, in addition to consolidating the two clerk's offices, eliminated three judgeships from criminal district court. All the way up until the 11th hour, the plan was to eliminate the last three judges in, which would be the first three judges out. So the legislature stuck by that script. They eliminated the most junior judge, which is Section J. That was Judge Durbany's section of court that stepped away after the Crime Commission pointed out that his docket had exploded to 500 open cases. The Supreme Court stepped in. He resigned. Ad hocs were appointed. A special election was called. And John Fuller won that election, knowing that that bill was pending and he probably wouldn't have a judgeship come January. The second most junior judge on there was Leon Roche, and the third most junior judge on there was Simone Levine. At the 11th hour, the legislature stuck with the script, eliminated the most junior judge, eliminated the third most junior judge, but skipped over the second most junior judge and went all the way up to the seventh most senior judge in that building, Judge Good Douglas, to eliminate her position in this thing. So that wasn't an act of God. That was an act of backroom, good old boy politics, skipping over Judge Roche to get to somebody that apparently didn't have any clout in the legislature. And Judge Good Douglas said, "I'm going to run against Judge Roche. They're eliminating my judgeship. I'm going to run against him." So when he was, you know, reading from his script for that video, he referred to them, the them being the governor, Senator Morris, and the Republicans. So judges, by the judicial canons, are not supposed to exhibit any prejudice or bias. That video, to me, reeks of prejudice and bias with respect to Republicans. So he is blaming the Republicans, the governor and members of the Republican leaders in the legislature, and then Now he's in charge of a grand jury that is investigating the Republican Attorney General. So he does not recuse himself until after the indictment is issued. My point is that if he recuses himself now, post-indictment, why didn't he recuse himself pre-indictment when all those biases and prejudices were there? The judge is supposed to follow the law. He didn't follow the law in appointing a conflicted special counsel in all of this. So, you know, what comes next? So what's going to happen next is now that the Supreme Court has appointed an ad hoc to preside over this, the defense defending the Attorney General will present evidence that and request that the indictment be quashed in this. And whichever way this rules, it's going to be appealed by the losing party to the Supreme Court. But the governor has already called for an investigation to be conducted by the Louisiana State Police. The Attorney General's office can't investigate this. The District Attorney's office can't investigate this. You know, it's going to be the Louisiana State Police. And what are they investigating? Well, grand jury proceedings are supposed to be confidential. And several days before the indictments were returned, the media started to report that a special grand jury was investigating this. I received reports that members of the legislature were informed of a pending grand jury investigation of the Attorney General's office and the Attorney General in this. So how did that information get from the grand jury? It's supposed to be confidential to the media and to members of the legislature. That's what the that is a violation of state law commanding that grand jury proceedings be confidential and secret. It began to leak out, and that's what the investigation is going to look at. Now, the penalty for leaking grand jury in matters, deliberations, and evidence is constructive contempt. And but if anybody is concealing this, now we're talking about if they're trying to eliminate paper trail or text messages or email messages or things like that, now you're talking about potential obstruction of justice. Now you're talking about a cover-up and malfeasance in office. That's what's going to be looked at by the attorney by the Louisiana State Police, how this information leaked out, and they're going to follow the evidence wherever it leads.
And I'm certain there's a list of names already generated of folks that said something about this to someone else, and there are no secrets. And so, you know, they'll follow the trail and they'll get somewhere. Got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll be right back. On a text line, what a circus of elected people in power doing exactly as they please, and we the taxpayers pay for all of this foolishness. It's disgusting that people are allowed to violate so many obvious laws and operations and just walk around like they're right. If this was your average Joe, we would be under the jail, period. We're back with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. We just have a few minutes left, and I know we want to talk about save the date of your 2026 Excellence in Law Enforcement Awards Luncheon, September 17th, 2026, at the Sheraton New Orleans, 500 Canal Street Grand Ballroom. As always, noon start to 1:30 p.m., and we'll be broadcasting live from that function on the 17th, so we look forward to that as well, Rafi.
Well, thank you for that. So if anyone's interested, you know, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. And, you know, we keep the lights on by people financially supporting us. And this is our sole public fundraising event of the year. And we keep the lights on by people attending this meeting and sponsoring the event. So if anyone is interested in sponsoring this event, you can contact us at our office, metrocrime.org, or 504-524-3148. The other thing that I wanted to announce briefly is the fact that we are now operating out of new offices. After 23 years at 1615 Poydras Street, right in front of the Superdome, we moved, the rent was going up, and we were offered an opportunity to move into the same building that New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation and New Orleans Sports Foundation operate. It's a building that's made available only to nonprofits. So we moved to this location 3 weeks ago. We're still unpacking. Nothing has changed other than our mailing address. So we're not going to change our operations. We've just changed our location. So just wanted to let people know that we have a new address now. It's 320 Metairie Hammond Highway, Suite 402 in Metairie, Louisiana. So this is the first time in 74 years the Metropolitan Crime Commission has moved outside of the corporate limits of the city of New Orleans. And my board, in approving this move, as I pointed out, was financially based, pointed out that when we were founded in 1952, our founders chose the name Metropolitan Crime Commission, not the New Orleans Crime Commission. So yes, we've had an address in the city of New Orleans for 74 years, but we were always contemplated as being a metropolitan area organization. Many of our cases and work that we perform involve multiple parishes. Now we're doing work literally all over the state. So just being at this location is not an indication that we're leaving behind our New Orleans roots. We're still going to continue to do all the things that we've done in New Orleans, and we're expanding into other areas every month. So this is a new address for us, but it's going to be the same Metropolitan Crime Commission going forward.
And I suspect you got an offer you couldn't refuse, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Absolutely. Rafi, as always, we appreciate the amount of work that you put into all of this and bringing it all together and making sense of it for our listening audience. They appreciate it as well. I hear from them every day when I'm out and about, and they really enjoy what you guys, hearing from you guys and what you guys do. And thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
We'll be right back, folks. Check in with Scoot when we return. Coming up on the Scoot Show, what's the difference between lying and not being honest? Are there ever times in your work or personal life where you may not lie, but you don't come clean completely, or you're not being transparent? Is that ever okay? Plus, ABC is standing up to the FCC over a freedom of speech issue. They're challenging the agency's inquiry into the TV show The View and whether or not equal time applies. Do you feel like freedom of speech is threatened in America? Jeffrey Epstein survivors put up a billboard in New Orleans to urge Senator Bill Cassidy to vote no on confirming Todd Blanche as Attorney General. We'll talk with Charlene Rochard, a survivor of Epstein's trafficking network, about why that's important. All of that coming up on Scoot on the Air from 1 to 4 today. So stay tuned. It's got a great lineup. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Thursday evening. We will see you guys in the morning.